And while we are talking about textbooks, I just wanted to say that I did use all of Dr. J. Wiles' textbooks for high school. And when we used the biology textbook, my son, Alex, who is an economist, actually, he passed the CLEP exam in biology after using that textbook. I think it might have been helpful that he was working at Discovery Institute, which works at the creation-evolution debate, so he knew a lot about evolution that way. And my son, Kevin, when he took college calculus, he brought his chemistry textbook that Dr. J. Wiles wrote into class because he preferred the way that Dr. Wiles explained math concepts to the way that his math textbook explained math concepts, which I thought was adorable. And Kevin also took his physics book that Dr. Wiles wrote, took that to college with him so that as he was becoming an engineer, he could read the chapter in Dr. Wiles' book before he would read the college textbook so that he could have a step up in the right direction. So yeah, we used and loved biology, chemistry, and physics in our home. And I recommend books written by Dr. J. Wiles. So, well, it looks like everybody is in the classroom. So let me just say that I am your host, Lee Benz. I'm the home scholar, and I'm so glad that you're joining me for this presentation today. I really hope that this is going to help Christian parents understand the different textbook myths. And I really think that it's going to help all parents to understand that textbooks can become outdated by the time your children get there. I know I experienced that as a registered nurse. I saw outdated textbooks all the time. So let me introduce you to my friend and fellow homeschool conference teacher, Dr. J. Wiles. You may recognize his name from the science textbooks that you have in your home at this very moment, like I do. Dr. J. Wiles holds a PhD in nuclear chemistry and a bachelor's of science in chemistry, both from the University of Rochester. And he's won several awards for excellence in teaching and has presented lectures in the U.S. and abroad on topics about nuclear chemistry, Christian apologetics, homeschooling, creation evolution, etc. He's probably best known for his award-winning K-12 science textbooks, and he's also a homeschool dad, was a homeschool dad with his wife, Kathleen. His daughter, Dawn, is now grown, but he homeschooled through high school, just like you and I are doing. So I would love for you all to chime in on chat and say hello to Dr. J. Wiles. And I will say, Jay, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. I always enjoy these video conferences. Yours seem to be some of the most well-attended ones of the ones I do, so that's really cool.
Oh, great.
So I appreciate that. And I appreciate all the nice words people are saying about my books.
And it's all true. We have all loved them. It's hard to find a well-written textbook for homeschoolers. Yeah. And it's so important because we don't know the topic. So yeah, we're counting on you. So. All righty. Well, I will let you take it from here. And I'm really eager to hear what you have to say. Thanks.
Okay, so, and as Lee said earlier, if you weren't in here when she was talking, you know, textbook errors are different than textbook myths. Textbooks have errors in them mostly these days because people expect textbooks to be turned around so quickly. Back when it was hard to typeset and hard to print, people took painstaking measures to find all the errors before the book went to publication. Nowadays, that you can do short print runs and everybody wants a fast turnaround, a lot more errors creep in. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about things that aren't, it wasn't mistakes that the authors made. It's actually things the authors believe, but are completely wrong. I just finished playing Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha. It's always been a dream role of mine. And one of the things Don Quixote says, he says that facts are the enemy of truth. And to some extent, that's true because facts, especially in science, do continually change. And if you cling too tightly to facts, you can often miss the truth. And this is especially true when the facts that you're getting are wrong because the textbook is promulgating a myth. So you think of it as fact because it's there in the textbook, but it's actually wrong, and you can't cling to these facts so much that you stop investigating to learn the truth. So I do want to talk about a few examples of myths that you find in textbooks and you still find in textbooks to these days, to this day, and then what you deal, how you deal with this, especially as a student at college. Okay. So one of the first myths you'll run across is that the church taught the earth is flat. This is a very popular myth. You'll hear it a lot. I certainly was taught it at university. I expect a lot of you were taught it. When you were at either high school or university. And the fact is that the church never taught the earth is flat. The vast majority of even the very, very ancient people, and even uneducated ancient people who lived near the ocean, understood that the earth is a sphere. And the first time, you know, I was taught that the ancient people thought the earth was flat and that the church taught the earth was flat. Those were just facts I was taught in school. And the first time I had an inkling this might be wrong is when my wife and I were in France, as your tax dollars sent me to France to do some experiments, and our own dollars brought my wife along so we could do the tourist thing for a while. And we were in the Louvre, looking at the statuary. I'm a big fan of statuary, so we were looking at the statuary, and we saw this statue. It was Atlas holding up the earth, and it's from the 2nd century AD. And my wife and I were admiring the statue, and I leaned over to her and I said, "Didn't everybody back then believe the earth is flat?" And she said, "Yeah, of course." And I said, "Well, this artist didn't, and he's from the 2nd century AD. That was my first inkling that something was wrong with the fact I had been taught. And if I had clung to the facts so much that I thought, well, this just must be a really forward-thinking artist, but still most people thought the earth was flat, I would have lost the truth. And the truth is, even the very ancient people, even uneducated ancient people, understood that the earth is a sphere. In fact, in roughly 200 BC, Eratosthenes actually measured the distance around the earth's sphere. He did that by taking a rod and finding a city where on a particular day of the year, the sun was directly overhead at noon. And he confirmed that his rod would cast no shadow because the sun was directly overhead. He then walked 500 miles due south, waited for the same time, the same day the next year, measured the length of the shadow that the rod formed. And from the length of the rod, the length of the shadow in 500 miles, he figured out the distance around the Earth's sphere. And he was correct to within 1% of today's satellite measured value. And this was back in 200 BC. So, like I said, the ancients really understood the Earth is a sphere. And in fact, even uneducated sailors knew the Earth is a sphere. In the Navy today, we have a term called hull down. And that means the ship is so far away, you can't see its hull, but you can see the rest of the ship. And that's because if you're on a sphere, the farther you are away, the harder it is to see the lower parts of whatever you're looking at. And of course, they didn't speak English back then, but there's a Greek equivalent the sailors use for that same term. And so even uneducated sailors understood that the earth is a sphere, and that's why ships look so weird when they're far away. So this wasn't something that ancients believed, and the early church taught the earth is a sphere. I've always wondered, you know, you always see these drawings and these portraits of the ancient church fathers, and I've always wondered how they're able to sleep with that big circle around their head. But nevertheless, I guess they were able to do that. But anyway, this is a portrait supposedly of Clement of Alexandria. He was one of the early church fathers, and he he lived from AD 150 to AD 215. So he's a very early church father. And here's what he said: how the earth and sea keep their place should, and how the earth and sea their place should keep, and when the seasons in their circling course, winter, summer, spring, and autumn, each should come according to a well-ordered plan out of a confused heap, who didst create this ordered sphere and from the shapeless mass. And obviously, you know, the language has loses something in translation, but he's talking about the earth as an ordered sphere. And this is one of the very early church fathers, and you can't find church fathers who definitively taught that the earth is flat. Scripture never says that, so they had no scriptural motivation for saying that. And obviously, they learned from the ancients that everyone understood the earth as a sphere. So the earth, early church never taught the earth is a sphere. The ancients never believed the earth is a sphere. But I'm sure you were taught that Christopher Columbus had trouble getting money for his voyage because everybody thought he would sail off the edge of the earth. I mean, I was taught that. I was taught that at the university level, that Christopher Columbus had trouble getting money for his voyage because everybody thought he was going to sail off the edge of the earth if he tried to get to the Indies by traveling the wrong way. And of course, that's just absolutely not true. We know why Christopher Columbus had trouble getting his money for his voyage, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But when I learned when I was at the Louvre and I saw that statue I talked about earlier, I came home and I decided to research this flat earth thing. And I came across Jeffrey Burton Russell's book called Inventing the Flat Earth, Columbus and Modern Historians. And here's what he says. The myth that people thought Columbus would sail off the edge of the earth was popularized by Washington Irving, who lived from 1783 to 1959. Now, if you don't recognize that name, he's the author of The Headless Horseman. He is a fictional author. All right, he's an author of fiction. He wrote a book called The Life and Times of Christopher Columbus, but it was a fictional account of Christopher Columbus's life. And he said in that book that this university council said, oh, you can't do this because you'll fall off the edge of the earth. Well, continuing on with Jeffrey Burton Russell's quote, according to respected Columbus biographer Samuel Eliot Morison, Irving's version of the story is, quote, pure moonshine. Washington Irving, sensing his opportunity for a picturesque and moving scene, created a fictitious account of this non-existent university council and let his imagination go completely. The whole story is misleading and mischievous nonsense. But nevertheless, this mischievous nonsense was in my high school textbooks and it was in my university textbooks. And nobody believed the earth was flat, even in 300 BC, much less in 1400s when Christopher Columbus proposed to sail around the world. Nevertheless, even really educated people still believe this nonsense. So, for example, California students at the California State University at Fullerton were asked what issue hampered Columbus in getting support for his voyage. 80% of these students who qualified to enter university at California State University, Fullerton, 80% said the issue was people thought the earth was flat. That is dead wrong. Here's the reason that Columbus had trouble getting money for his voyage. Because of the work of Eratosthenes back in 200 BC, people knew how far he would have to travel to go around the earth. And no one believed that anyone could make that long a journey without running out of supplies. And of course, if he hadn't found the New World, they would have been proven right, because he wouldn't have made it all the way around the world. They were running pretty low on supplies by the time they found the New World. So in the end, it had nothing to do with the shape of the earth, because everybody from very ancient times understood that the earth is a sphere. However, because of Eratosthenes back in 200 BC, they knew how far around that sphere was, and nobody thought Columbus could make that voyage. Only 1% of the students at California State University Fullerton knew that answer. And so that just shows you've got this story that is complete moonshine, as one historian called it, that's totally false, misleading and mischievous nonsense. But it ends up getting in the textbooks because, you know, oh, I'm going to talk about why in a minute. But anyway, it gets into the textbooks and it starts being repeated as fact, when in fact, it's completely wrong. Oh, yeah. No, Kim just said amazing. Wonder what else I believe is not true. I mean, a lot of what you were taught in school is wrong. You know, now some of it is because we've learned more, and it was when you were taught it, it was originally thought to be right. But a lot of it is this mythology comes about because textbooks often promulgate these very wrong things. And that's what I'm talking about as textbook myths. So, where did the idea that the church taught a flat earth originate? I think we know. Dr. James Hannum is a historian who specializes in church history, and he says the myth that a flat earth was part of Christian doctrine in the Middle Ages appears to have originated with Sir Francis Bacon, who wasn't living in the Middle Ages. He was living in 1561 to 1626, which is the heart of the Renaissance. Who wrongly claimed that geographers had been put on trial for impiety after asserting the contrary. So for Sir Francis Bacon wanted to make the church look bad and say, oh, these church people, they were putting people on trial for saying the earth was round. When in fact, you can't find any church document that ever even said that, much less people being put on trial for impiety for saying otherwise. So anyway, we know now, we know for certain that the church never taught this and that that it wasn't even an ancient idea. Even the very ancient people thought the earth was round. So how did the myth become popular? How can something that's misleading and mischievous nonsense end up becoming fact and being taught to unsuspecting students like me? Well, most textbook authors don't rely on primary or secondary sources, and I recognized that when I started writing my elementary science curriculum. I have an elementary science curriculum that's different from the Apologia curriculum. The author of that elementary science curriculum is Jeannie Fulbright. I have an elementary science curriculum that teaches science in the order we learned it. So it's a chronological approach to science. And so in order to actually write a good textbook about science and history, I had to read a lot of original sources, a lot of primary documents. When I wanted to teach students what Christopher Columbus taught, I read Christopher Columbus's book. The English translation, of course. When I wanted to talk about Vesalius, who was, you know, the guy who revolutionized our study of anatomy, I read his 6-volume set. Didn't read it all, but I read large portions of his 6-volume set on anatomy, the English translation, of course, in order to understand what he actually wrote. And when I did that, I found that most of what I had been taught about Vesalius and Columbus Copernicus were wrong. That in fact, what I had been taught about what Copernicus said and what Vesalius said, they said quite the opposite. And it's because most textbook authors don't take the time to do this. So they repeat what others have said. So once you get one author who's, you know, pretty well known to say something, it often just gets repeated mindlessly, whether it's true or not. This particular myth also becomes popular because it buys into this idea that ancient people were ignorant and stupid. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've noticed this especially with my students at university. Most of these people ignore what the ancients wrote because they think the ancients were stupid. In fact, the ancients are smarter than we are. There was an article written in a science journal called Gene several years ago that made the strong case that people are stupider now than they were in ancient times because a lot of the genes that have to do with our neural development have mutated. And as a result, our neurological development isn't as good as those of the ancient people. But the way to see that the ancient people were a lot smarter than us is just to read them. You know, I have to pour over people like Plato and Socrates to understand what they're saying. You know, and I'm a PhD in nuclear chemistry. If I have to pour over the things that these ancient people were saying, they aren't dumb. They aren't at all dumb. So, but this myth that's been promoted for so long buys in to that cultural stereotype. And that's really, really bad, but it's the reason it gets promoted like that. Here's another scientific myth. I don't know if you know this, but you don't have any blue blood in your body. And I'm not talking about the blue bloods that's associated with aristocrats, but there are textbooks out there that say some of your blood is blue. So here's a couple of quotes from textbook for people who are treating people for stroke. So the textbook's title is called Stroke, and it's for people who treat those with stroke. And it was published in 2008, so this isn't an old book or anything like that. And it says, quote, the various body organs have used up the oxygen in this blood, so the returning venous blood is blue. And this is something that a lot of students believe, that the blood in your arteries is red because it's got oxygen in it, but the blood in your veins is blue because it's lost that oxygen, and when it loses its oxygen, it turns blue. So that's absolutely false. Here's another one. This was published 2 years later, 2010, so just 7 years ago. And please understand, we've known this since the 1500s. A guy by the name of Malpighi was first to show that blood changes from bright red to darker red when it loses oxygen. So we've known this since the 1500s. This isn't new information. But something published just 7 years ago, pulmonary arterial hypertension. Once again, it's a textbook for people who are treating folks. And it's published by Oxford University Press, which is one of the most prestigious academic publishers that exist. But nevertheless, it says, it promulgates this mix. Oxygen is extracted, removed from the hemoglobin when the blood reaches the organs and cells. Red cells without oxygen look dark blue. That is absolutely false. No truth to that whatsoever. Oxygen-rich blood is bright red. Oxygen-poor blood is dark red. There is no blue blood anywhere in your body. Doesn't matter how much oxygen you take out of the blood. It doesn't go from red to blue. It goes from bright red to dark red. There's two reasons this myth persists. One is because drawings of the circulatory system typically use red for arterial blood and blue for the blood in the veins. It's a nice way to tell which way the blood is moving, because blood coming from the organs is venous blood, and so in the diagrams it's blue. Blood coming from the heart, after it's been oxygenated by the lungs, is red, and so the arterial blood is red. But that's just for convenience. That's just to be able to see the difference between the veins and the arteries. That's not real. But since it's there as a help to guide the eye, it tends to reinforce the myth. And of course, something else that reinforces the myth is look down at your wrist right now. You know, stop looking at the screen, look down at your wrist, and look at the blood vessels that you see through your skin. What color are they? They're blue. Now, the body has been designed by a master craftsman, so your arteries are deeper in your body than your veins. Your veins are closest to the surface because your veins, you don't lose as much blood from when they're cut. So I want to protect the arteries. It's more dangerous to cut an artery than a vein. So your veins are on top of your arteries. They're closer to your skin. So when you look through your skin at your blood vessels, you're looking at your veins, not your arteries. They look blue. That's not because they're actually blue. It's because the light that's coming from them, the way you see something, is for light to reflect off it and then come back to your eyes. So the light has to travel through your skin, hit those veins, and then come back through your skin to hit your eyes. That distorts the color. Blue light is more energetic, so it's more likely to make the full trip through your skin two times to get to your eyes. So blues are enhanced, reds are the lowest energy, they are muted. So in the end, they look blue when in fact they're dark red. All right? So the myth persists because of illustrations and because of what you see without knowing all the details of different colors of light and the energy of light and so forth. But nevertheless, it is a myth. It is utterly false, but you'll find it in many, many textbooks. Here's another one. Everybody celebrates Thanksgiving, right? It's a wonderful holiday. It's a time for family to get together. Thanksgiving's a wonderful thing. Please understand virtually everything you've been taught about Thanksgiving is a myth. And it's not necessarily because it's wrong. It's because we just don't know. The first Thanksgiving was not a big deal. I mean, I'm sure it was a big deal to the people at the time because they were celebrating the bounty that they finally had. But all of these details you've learned about the first Thanksgiving, pretty much made up. And you'll see how much we actually know about the first Thanksgiving in a minute. So then you can decide how much of what you've been taught is completely made up. The definitive work about the Pilgrims is Bradford's own book of Plymouth Plantation. Thick book that talks about the Pilgrims and what happened to them and so forth. Please understand there is absolutely no reference to the first Thanksgiving in the definitive work about the Pilgrims. So Bradford's own work describing his, voyage and his work and so forth doesn't mention the first Thanksgiving at all. The only reference to the first Thanksgiving is in a letter from Edward Winslow, who was Bradford's assistant. In his book, The First Thanksgiving, Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie says, in his letter, the main purpose of which was to convince the investors that they weren't throwing their money away, Winslow described the houses the Pilgrims had built, listed the crops they had planted, and emphasized the success they had been blessed with. To underscore the latter, he added 5 sentences describing the abundance they now enjoyed. So everything we know about the first Thanksgiving is contained in 5 sentences that Bradford's assistants wrote to his investors. All right? That's all we know. And here it is. Here is the sum total knowledge of everything we know about the first Thanksgiving. This is Winslow's own words. Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling, so they were shooting birds, so that we might, after a more special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered the fruit of our labors. They 4 in one day killed as much fowl as, with a little help besides, served the company almost a week. At which time, among other recreations, we exercised our arms. That means they did military exercises. Many of the Indians coming amongst us, and amongst the rest, their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted. And they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed upon our governor and upon the captain and others. That's everything we know about the first Thanksgiving. If you were taught that we invited the Native Americans, the Pilgrims invited the Native Americans to join us, we don't know that. We know they were there, but we don't know why. They may have just smelled the food and come. We don't know that they were invited. All we know is that they ate some birds, but we don't know what kind of birds they were. We don't know they were turkeys. Now, turkeys were plentiful in that area, but we don't know. One thing that's almost always left out of every description of the first Thanksgiving is one thing that we do know, and that was it included military exercises. Have you ever been taught that Thanksgiving included military exercises? Well, one of the few things we know about the first Thanksgiving is that it did. the point is, we know very little about the first Thanksgiving. So much of what you've been taught has been made up out of whole cloth. It's possible that what you've been told is true, but we just don't know. Because in the end, there's very little we actually know about the first Thanksgiving. And here's the last one I want to talk about before I go into how you deal with this stuff. There are a lot of textbooks that will tell you the concept of God is incompatible with science. So Dr. John Ellis wrote a textbook called How Science Works. And here's what he said. It follows that science is incompatible with religion. Why is this? It is because once you attribute any particular event to a supernatural agent, a proposition that cannot be disproven by observation or experiment, then science becomes both irrelevant and impossible. Virtually everything in that statement is utterly false. But nevertheless, it's in a science textbook that's entitled How Science Works. That's just wrong. We know, in fact, that the concept of God is integral to science. At least it was integral to the development of science. And this was shown beyond a reasonable doubt in 1938 when Dr. Joseph Needham asked a very important question, it's now known as the Needham question because it was very important. He was a microbiologist. He was a working scientist, but he, you know, dabbled in science history, and he noticed that China was way ahead of Western, of Europe when it came to technology. You know, they had fireworks, they had gunpowder and so forth long before the Europeans did. They had silk before the Europeans did. They had all sorts of technology, but it was the Europeans who ended up developing science. And so the question was, why was China overtaken by the West in science and technology, even though ancient China was advanced compared to ancient Europe? And he proposed this at a few of the scientific conferences that he was at, and a group decided to fund him to try and find out. So they funded him, and he went to China and spent several years there examining primary sources, learning the language, examining primary sources to try and find out what happened in China, what didn't happen in China that did happen in Europe. He ended up writing a 24-volume series because those people with PhDs can't write short sentences, right? So in the end, he ended up having a 24-volume series that describe, and it's called Science and Civilization in China. And it describes the history of China and how science developed there and how it didn't develop there, how technology did it develop there and science did not. It was named one of the 100 best nonfiction books of the 20th century by the Modern Library Board. So this was a very, very important work. And in this work, he gave three reasons for why China did not develop science. The first two dealt with Chinese law and bureaucracy. In Chinese law, evidence wasn't very important. Your guilt or innocence was determined by the status of the person accusing you. If the status of the person accusing you was high and you were low, you were guilty no matter what. Also, Chinese bureaucracy fought against innovation. They wanted to keep things the same. So those were the first two reasons, but here's his third reason. The autochthonous, and that means native, that means coming from the culture that you're studying. The autochthonous idea of a supreme being, though certainly present from the earliest time, soon lost the qualities of personality and creativity. The development of the concept of a precisely formulated abstract laws capable, because of the rationality of the author of nature, of being deciphered and restated, did not therefore occur. If you're having trouble getting through the PhD language here, what he's saying is they didn't have a God concept. They didn't have a concept of God as the author of nature. And because they didn't have a law-giving God as the author of nature, they didn't think there were laws that governed nature. So in fact, the whole idea of a creator God was absolutely essential to the development of science, and a culture that didn't have that idea couldn't develop science. So we know for a fact that actually the concept of religion is absolutely important, and the kind of religion you have is absolutely important for science, and you need a concept of a law-giving creator God, and that's why Christian Europe developed science. The Arabs and a lot of Egyptians had great math, but they didn't have science because they needed the concept of a law-giving a creator. And that's what Christianity gave Europe. And that's why Europe developed science. So the idea that the concept of God is incompatible with science is crazy. And in fact, many of the scientific breakthroughs that occurred throughout the history of science occurred specifically because of the scientists' Christian faith. And if they hadn't been Christians, they wouldn't have considered this. So one of the most famous ones is Copernicus. So Copernicus started the scientific revolution because he took the Earth out of the center of the solar system. He called it the universe. But they took the sun out, or the Earth out of the center of the solar system, and put the sun there. He had a few observations that he used to support his argument. But here was the most important one. He said that this Earth-centered universe doesn't work. It's very messy. all sorts of exceptions have to be put in order to get the universe to work. That Earth-centered universe was simply too messy. And he specifically said this went against the nature of God, who is, quote, the best and most orderly workman, quote, unquote. So in the end, he put the sun at the center of what he called the universe, we now call it the solar system, at the center of the solar system because of his idea of how God would create. Now, if you've been taught about Copernicus, most likely you've been taught that he was arguing against the church. He didn't think he was arguing against the church. He thought he was actually making a religious argument, a Christian argument, that God is not a messy God, so he wouldn't have made a messy universe. And in fact, his work was supported wholeheartedly by the Pope at the time. So in the end, he wasn't fighting against the church. He was actually using his Christian faith to come up with a good scientific theory about how the universe works. So how do you deal with these kinds of things? We have all these myths that are around in textbooks. How do you deal with it? How do you figure out what's true and what's not? Well, first of all, you have to realize that some of what you've learned over the years is probably wrong. In fact, I could probably say some of what you've learned over the years is definitely wrong. It may be a good fraction, it may be a small fraction, but almost certainly some of what you have learned is wrong. You have to just accept that. So you have to be open-minded. When you hear something that contradicts something you've been taught over and over again, don't just ignore it because it contradicts what you've been taught over and over again. Ignore it if you have good reasons to ignore it. Don't dismiss a fact out of hand because a textbook says something different. I'm a Christian. And as a Christian, I quote scripture a lot. And when something goes against a quote in scripture, I know it's wrong, right? Because scripture is 100% right. Textbooks are not scripture. And as a result, you can quote a textbook, but it could still be wrong. And you have to understand that. Textbooks are not perfect. And so just because there's a fact in a textbook, you can't dismiss the contrary out of hand because the contrary might be fact. When you run across something in a textbook or a college class that contradicts what you may have learned, be willing to look into it. Now, of course, maybe not right away because you've got college to deal with and so forth. So, you know, but put that in, you know, a notebook or something that says, you know, at some point I want to look into this. This is what I did when I saw the statue of Atlas in Paris. At the time, I was touring with my wife, and then I was going to go do an experiment for a month, and those are all-consuming things, so I didn't have time. But eventually I did have time to look into this flat earth thing, and I was shocked by what I read. So I didn't do it right away, and I don't expect you to do it right away. But when you run across something that contradicts what you've learned, be willing to look into it at some point. So, of course, the next question is, how do you do that? How do you look into it? Well, one thing is you can find sources that are thought to be reliable and compare them. Don't just find one source and say, well, this one source says this, therefore it's got to be true. No, no. Find two or three sources and see if they contradict each other. This is what sort of started me on the path of reading the original works of people like Copernicus and Vesalius when I was writing science textbooks from a historical perspective, my new elementary curriculum. Because in the end, I was looking at authoritative sources and they would contradict each other about what these guys actually said. So I had no choice but to go read the primary literature to find out what these guys actually said. So here are some examples of reliable sources. And like I said, one reliable source isn't good enough. If you can get five or six reliable sources to agree, it's probably right. Academic articles. There are web indexes that allow you to search academic articles. So, for example, this link here, ncbi.nlm.nih.gov/PubMed, is for scientific articles related to health and biology. And if you search that index, then perhaps you can find some authoritative sources. Wikipedia references. I never believe anything I read on Wikipedia, but I will use Wikipedia a lot to find its references. So if I'm looking at a particular subject I don't know very well, I'll go over to Wikipedia, I'll ignore the article, and I'll look at the references that are linked in the article, because the references generally tell me something useful. The Wikipedia source probably doesn't, but the references often do. Also, any website that has a .edu extension, this is usually university or high school websites. And although the academies, schools, textbooks can be wrong, at least they're not trying to sell you something. So in the end, they're probably a little more reliable than the websites that are trying to sell you something. You can look at try and look at different reliable sources and see if these reliable sources agree. The more reliable sources that agree, the more likely the fact is true. Also, check references. This is really important. Oftentimes, articles are full of references that have nothing to do with the stated fact. So if a reference is given and you're really interested about whether this fact is true, check the reference to see that it actually says what the author claims it says. So this is my example from this personal experience. I didn't read it in 2006. I think I read it in about 2008. Neuropsychologist Luann Brezendine, who at the time was a pretty well-respected neuropsychiatrist, wrote a book called The Female Brain. Now, any man should be interested in reading a book called The Female Brain to try and figure this odd structure out. I read The Female Brain to try and better understand my wife, right? And one thing she said in this Female Brain is that women on average use 20,000 words per day, while men use only 7,000. You ever heard that? I took that. She had a reference. So I just took that to heart. You know, I didn't even bother to check the reference. I just believed her. And so oftentimes when I was tired of talking, I would tell my wife, I've used up my words. You need to go to someplace else to use up your words. I'm done for the day. And so I used that enough that my wife finally said, I actually want to see the study that this woman references. So I go and look at the study. The study has absolutely nothing to do with counting words that people use. It has nothing to do. It's a study about how women and men talk differently. They talk about different things and they talk in different ways. But nowhere in the entire article is there anything mentioning the number of words that men and women use. So I did my own research using that PubMed index I told you about before. And I just said number of words, men and women, and did a search. And every article I found that actually talks about this doesn't say anything about men and women using different numbers of words. The latest article that I can find says that men and women each use about 16,000 words per day. And there's no difference on average between men and women in the terms of the number of words. Absolutely false. But Brezendine at that time was considered a reliable source. So news articles picked it up. I believed it and everything. It turns out it's just utterly not true. And so just because the author has a reference there, if it's a fact you really want to believe, at least check the reference and make sure the reference actually says that. Because that's really important. Most importantly, don't be stressed over this, right? When you're in university, your first job is to make sure the professor understands that you have read and studied the material, that you have a good work ethic, and that you've retrained what he or she is trying to teach you. So give the answer the professor wants, even if you don't know whether or not it is accurate. I said this in my last talk. I'll say it again. When I had to answer a question on the test where the answer I believed was wrong, but nevertheless, I knew that was what the professor would want, I would write the answer, I'd put a little star next to it, and then at the bottom of the page, I'd put another star, and I'd say, this is not the correct answer, but it's the one you're looking for. And so that way I could show the professor that I studied the material and I learned what he or she was trying to teach me. I just thought that what he or she was trying to teach me was wrong. That's an important thing to understand. Be willing to question much of what you've learned. That's one thing college is all about. You need to question what you've learned because you need to find the truth for yourself. So college is about questioning, you know, what you've learned, because some of what you've learned is absolutely false. Okay. So that's all I've got. I did want to take questions. Now, last time the questions were helpfully pointed out to me, and I see one here. Oh, Anna Pratchett's asking how my play was. Anna, it was delightful. We were sold out every performance, and the audience gave us a standing ovation 2 out of 3 performances. And people who talked to me afterwards said they just loved it. The cast was truly stellar. The girl who played opposite me, she plays the prostitute that Don Quixote treats like a woman, treats like a lady, calls her by a lady's name. And by the end of the play, after Don Quixote has died, she thinks she's a lady. And she starts acting like a lady. She brought me to tears on stage every night. And so we heard sniffles throughout the audience all 3 nights. So it was truly a wonderful experience. And it was a dream come true for me. I've always wanted to play that role. If you don't know, I used to be a professional actor right out of high school before I went to college. I actually spent a year trying to be a professional actor. Was fairly successful at the time, but realized it wasn't the job that I wanted to make a career out of. So then I went to university and made the next logical step and started studying chemistry and then nuclear chemistry. But anyway, that was one of my very first professional plays. I was just in the chorus. But I always dreamed of playing that role and could not believe that I finally got to the point of actually being able to play it. So Logan says, my son would respond the same way I said, that he would to respond, say, this isn't the correct answer. You know, I was never punished for it. Some, professor, I can't remember exactly. I tried to recall this for the last, talk. I think it was like 5 or 6 professors, that I ended up having to do this for. And 2 of them actually talked to me in their office hours, asked me to stop by their office hours. And we had actually a really nice conversation because they want to know, well, why do you think this is wrong? Because they were actually interested in trying to see if there was something they were teaching that was wrong, or if maybe they could clear up my head so I would find out that their answer was right. So at least 2 of the professors were willing to do that. The rest didn't react any way, but never was I punished in any way. And of course, you can be softer than I was. Back then, I was a pretty fervent guy. Nowadays, I'm a little more laid back. So I probably would have said something nowadays if I were to go back. I'd probably say something like, I don't believe this is the correct answer, but I do know it's the one you're looking for. So I might not have been as dogmatic as I was back then, but I was kind of a firebrand back then. Susan asks, would you consider writing a history book? No, I don't have enough knowledge to write a history book. I can, you know, because the history of science is very specific, and I had learned a lot of it, some of it wrong, or much of it wrong, but I'd learned a lot of it already. I felt qualified to talk about the history related to science, but I would have to spend way too much time trying to write a history book, and I don't think my result would be it would probably have more myths in it than anything else whenever I strayed from the history of science. So I'll stick with the history of science. Any advice for a high school child who wants to pursue acting in theater? Is college the best avenue to that end? Nowadays it is, Beverly. I would have said back when I was a professional actor, it was best to go right out of high school and start acting. Get your face out there, get exposure, and get on an equity-approved stage and start earning hours towards union credit so that you could become a part of the union. Nowadays, since there are so many more people who want to act, and all of them are absurdly talented, you need connections, and your connections are best fostered in university or in college, because your professor will know people, you'll do summer things that the university connects you with, and the people you do the summer things with, they'll have connections. So nowadays, connections are much more important than they were in my day. So the best course of action is to go to university or go to college, get a degree in fine arts or something like that, major in theater, major in dance, whatever you're thinking of doing, because that way you're going to get the contacts, and the contacts are the important thing these days. Rhonda asked, I wonder if in today's politically correct climate, profs would be less open to such a comment. That could very well be true. So your student may want to word the statement more congenially. They may maybe make it more friendly. but yes, I would say that it may be that in politically correct climate today, it would be harder for a professor to accept an answer like that. In the last talk I gave about advice to college students, one thing I did say was accept it. Sometimes you're going to get unfair grades because professors are people too, and sometimes you just can't get past their personality. So it's possible that's one of those cases where you might just get a lousy grade because of that. Conrad, you are right. The second half of the play, during part of the play, he starts off the play, Don Quixote starts off the play wearing a helmet that looks like a Spanish conquistador helmet. But along the way, he encounters a barber who is wearing his shaving basin on his head to ward off the rays of the sun. Don Quixote believes it's a legendary helmet, takes it from the barber, and wears it for the rest of the play. So many of the pictures that I have me with this overturned shaving basin on my head. So, yes, that's very true. So Giovanni asked, how in the world am I supposed to know what the book says is right or wrong? At first, you don't. But you can eventually look into it. The key is make sure you're not holding on to what you've been taught so strongly that you refuse to look into ideas that contradict what you've been taught. That's the key. Wendy's asking, so how do you deal with profs who are uneducated and don't want to be shown up by their students? My homeschool nephew had a prof that lacked factual knowledge, and she never gave him more than a C since he was constantly proving her wrong. In turn, he got exasperated and dropped out of college. Well, I'll tell you two things about that. Like I told my class last time, you're going to get some unfair grades, and you just have to deal with it because professors are people. My father, when he went, he went to the war and fought Hitler and all of that. And then when he came back on the GI Bill, he went to college, and one of his English professors said, "Look, you no matter what you write, I'm giving you a C because you write like a journalist, and journalistic writing is just mediocre. So I'm going to give you a C no matter what you do." And so eventually he started writing papers as best he could. And he kept getting C's. So he then started just spending less time on it because he knew he was going to get a C. And so, in the end, it helped him a little bit because he didn't have to spend as much time. But sometimes you just have to accept that. The other thing, and I said this in my last class too, and I'll say this very, very strongly again in this class, never, ever, ever, ever confront your professor in class. Unless the professor specifically says, I'm looking for alternate opinions here. At that point, then you can confront, but never, ever, ever confront your professor in class. If you're doing that, then your professor's hackles are going to go up, and most likely you're never going to get through to him. Also, a professor will always win the argument. I can take any incorrect scientific thing and argue for it and win against any student. So right now, if a student came to me and tried to argue that the earth was round, if I wanted to, I could prove to him the earth is flat because I know more than the student. So in the end, I can make that work for me. So first of all, you're not going to change your professor's mind by confronting him or her in class, and you're not going to win. So the best thing to do is confront, either not confront and just do what I said on the test, or if you really think you need to confront your professor, do it in private during office hours. The worst thing you can do is confront a professor in class. That's the absolute worst thing you can do. And like I said, unless the professor, some professor is specifically saying, I'm looking for alternate opinions here. Do you disagree with me? Tell me why. And especially you'll find that in philosophy classes and things like that. That's really, really important. Joey is asking, with the popularity of quantum physics, do you foresee any textbooks teachings on the subject? I could write a popular level book about quantum physics because quantum physics is real. Obviously it's incomplete. We know it's incomplete because it contradicts relativity, and relativity is real too. So general relativity explains the universe really well. Quantum physics explains the atom very well, and they're totally incompatible on certain levels. So we know they're not complete, But quantum physics is a very real thing. Relativity is a very real thing. And I have thought about writing a popular book on that for students so that, you know, they aren't misinformed. You know, a lot of people have odd ideas about what quantum physics and relativity say. And so they argue against them because of that point. But you cannot argue against relativity on the universal scale. And you cannot argue against quantum physics on the atomic scale. They are incomplete. There are things we don't understand. But pretty much every experiment that's ever been done confirms quantum physics and relativity. And that's what's cool about science. Every experiment that's ever been done confirms them both, and they contradict each other. So that's what makes science so fun. How does your elementary curriculum compare to Apologia's curriculum? A few things. First of all, I don't do subjects. Apologia's curriculum is written very traditionally. There's zoology, there's botany, there's astronomy, and so forth. I don't do that. I'm doing a chronological approach. So you're learning science as it developed. I personally think this gives the student a really good idea of how science works. Also, unlike the Apologia books, my books are separated into lessons. You know where to start and stop every time you do science. And the lessons are typically 3 pages long. That includes instructions for an experiment and the review. So they are short, bite-sized pieces of science. Also, every time you do science, you only do science every other day or twice a week, depending on how you choose to cover the books. But every time you do science, there's a hands-on activity. So it's more hands-on than the Apologia. Now, that's not neither good. That doesn't mean mine is better. It's just different. So there are some students who will react better to hands-on activities every time they do science. There will be some students who don't react well to that. So you want to see whether your student is really hands-on oriented or not. That's one way to decide who's to use. Also, if your student likes history, they're going to be more drawn to my program. If your student doesn't like history, they're going to be less drawn to my program. April's asking, is the debate more about the causes of global warming, man-made versus part of a much wider cycle that may not fit the cycle seen in recorded history? I think that's the real debate about global warming. The real debate about global warming, we know that the globe has warmed a little bit. It's warmed, you know, a little more than a degree Celsius over the past 100 years. We know that. But we also think, and we don't know this, we also think that in the past, the Earth was a lot cooler, and in the past, the Earth was a lot warmer. Most climatologists say there was a little ice age in the 1800s that was cooler than today, or in the 1700s. And then there was a medieval warm period around the 1200s, which was hotter than today. So we do know there are cycles in the Earth. So is the small amount of warming we're seeing over the last 100 years, is it because of the carbon dioxide we're emitting in the air? Or is it part of some other cycle? And honestly, from a scientific point of view, we don't know. I don't care what anybody tells you. We don't know. In fact, we don't even know how much the Earth is warmed. We have 3 ways of measuring Earth's global temperature. And 2 of the data sets say 1 level of warming, and the 3rd data set says a higher level of warming. Guess which one you always see in the press? The higher one. So thermometers situated all around the world give the hottest Earth. Satellites and radio and weather balloons give a lower average temperature for the Earth. And this has been the true since 1979 when the satellites were first launched for measuring weather. So we don't even know exactly how much the Earth is warmed. Satellites and radio balloons say one thing, or weather balloons say one thing, thermometers say another thing. We also know that whatever's going on, the North Pole is losing ice, but the South Pole is gaining ice. And we don't understand that either. So we don't really know a lot about climate. We do know, the one thing we do know is it is human activity that's causing the increase in carbon dioxide. That's one thing we know. We can watch the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increasing over time. We know that. We've measured it. We've measured it for many, many years. So we know it's increasing over time. And most of the budgets that have been studied that show how much carbon dioxide is caused by natural processes, how much is caused by humans, and how much is taken up by natural processes, show that humans are burning about 26 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide, making about 26 billion tons of carbon dioxide. Now, natural processes make 771 billion tons, so that's a lot more, but natural processes also take about 750-something. So if it weren't for human burning of fossil fuel, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere would actually be going down right now. So we know it's human fossil fuel that's causing the carbon dioxide levels to go up. What we don't know is how that's affecting global climate. We really, truly don't know. Yeah, I do agree, Lee, that at one time we were taught that the Earth was cooling, because there was a period of time, if you look at the temperature records, this was back when only thermometers were available, there was a period of about 20 years where the Earth's temperature was decreasing. So during that time, everybody thought there was global cooling going on. However, there wasn't a real known mechanism for that. Nowadays, we have both a warming planet and we have a mechanism that might be responsible for it. So that's why I think a lot of people are more likely to believe that we're causing global warming, because we can at least link it to human activities. The data don't link it necessarily, but at least we have a theoretical understanding of why human activities might be causing the Earth to warm. Beverly's asking, are there algebra courses which are better than others as preparatory instruction for your chemistry curriculum? Algebra 1. I'll tell you, I don't like to talk bad about curriculum, so I'm not going to tell you the ones I don't like. I'll tell you the ones I like. I think Saxon overall is a really good, useful source for most students. Some students will find it too repetitive. It doesn't teach really the ideas behind math. It just teaches you how to problem solve. But honestly, I don't need to know the idea behind a hammer. I just need to know how it works. So for math, I don't care if I don't understand the ideas of math. As long as I can use it as a tool, I'm happy with that. I like Video Text Interactive a lot. The way they solve problems is exactly the way I think. So as a scientist, I'm drawn to that program. However, video programs can be slow for a lot of students, because you do have to watch the video and you can't fast forward because, you know, then you lose stuff. So in the end, video is not great for all students. It can be slow. I think Singapore Math does a great job, but it's much more parent intensive. So if you have a lot of kids, Singapore Math is probably not something you can use. I like Matthew C. If you're going to go for some sort of blend between video and book, I think Matthew C. is a really good choice. Those are the ones I would recommend. How is my high school chemistry textbook different from the new edition of Apologia High School Chemistry? I've got a pithy answer for that, but I'm not going to say it because I want to be a gentleman. I think the main issue is what they did with their chemistry book is they took my second edition chemistry book, chopped it up, and rearranged the sections. To me, that makes it very confusing, because when I wrote the second edition book, I wrote it as a narrative. It's a story. Now they've chopped up the story, reordered the chapters, and they want you to try and understand it. I don't think that works. My new book was written from the beginning as telling a story. So every idea is connected. On my blog, which is blog.drweil.com, one of the articles is a report from a parent and a student who are comparing. They started using Apologia's book, got so frustrated that they contacted my publisher. My publisher convinced them to buy my book. They're much happier. And in that article, they say why. So blog.drweil.com, if you just search on chemistry or something like that, you'll find the article pretty quickly. And that the student says exactly the same thing, that the ideas are connected in my book. They're not connected in the Apologia book. One other huge difference, the reason you want to do a new edition of a chemistry book isn't because the science has changed that much, but what's available to do experiments has changed. And one thing, the third edition of the Apologia book, it doesn't change hardly any of the experiments. It changes a couple of them, and one of them is impossible to do with the kit that they give you. So in the end, they haven't changed the most important part to change. In my book, every experiment is new, because the things that are available to households is different. So you can do better experiments now than you could do when the second edition of the chemistry was written. So I obviously think it's a better book, but I'm going to say that because it's my book. Grace is doing Apology of Biology on her own, so thank you for asking this. I love it when students ask the questions. How often do you think I should work on your lessons and for how long each time? I honestly think you want to do it every day, and how long depends on how well you study and how fast you read. I tell students, start out at 45 minutes a day. And at 45 minutes a day, you should be done with the chapter in about a week and a half, 1 week, and then 3 working days of the next week, so that you now have 2 days to study for and take the test. And if that's what you do, 45 minutes a day gets you through the test in 2 weeks, that's the time you need. If you're not quite through the test in 2 weeks, you need to spend more than 45 minutes a day. If you're well past the test after 45 minutes a day, spend less. But find the time that allows you to take about 8 school days to get through the book, chapters or the modules, and then 2 days, one for study and one for taking the test. So Amy says, what would you recommend for your son's last 2 years of science? He's an engineering track and interested in electrical and biomechanical engineering and has had biology and chemistry. Okay, so engineering track, you definitely need to do physics. You definitely need to do physics. No matter what kind of engineering you're going to do, physics is going to be an integral part of the initial first couple of years of your work. So take physics. If you still think engineering, I honestly do think advanced physics would be more important. Even though he wants to do biomechanical, you might think biology. No. If you want to be a successful engineer, you need to know physics like the back of your hand. So I would do physics and advanced physics. And the other thing you could do is do my physics. And then if you've got a local college who accepts homeschoolers, as a lot of local colleges do, you could do the local college's calculus-based or at least the physics that's appropriate for engineers, and then see how that goes. What do you think of Rate My Professors to find sound professors? You know, I think Rate My Professors, I wouldn't look at the numbers at all. I would read the individual accounts and see if these are people grinding an axe or honestly talking. I think the numbers mean very little. So if you don't know what Rate My Professors is, it's a website you can go to where students voluntarily tell you how good or how bad the professors are, and they give you a ranking and a number, numerical score. Those numerical scores mean nothing, in my opinion. But if you scroll through what the students' reactions are, you can generally see who has a legitimate complaint and who's just grinding an axe. So that's what I do. Am I working on any new textbooks right now? Currently, I'm teaching some online courses for homeschoolers, and I'm also teaching a university course. So my days are pretty full right now. However, in the summer, I do plan on working on a 7th grade book that culminates my elementary series. So my elementary series goes up to 1900 and stops there, with the idea that in junior high, you start learning modern science. So I'm thinking that in 7th grade, I'll do a historical approach that in 7th grade covers from the 1900s on. And it'll be a historical approach that does, so it kind of carries on my elementary. I realize that might mean that there are 2 7th grade books out there by Jay Weil, but that's fine. You just use the one that's appropriate. If your student has used my elementary books, my 7th grade book, if I ever write it, will be better for them. So that's, okay. Let's see. I think I went the wrong way here, so I have to go back, now. And see, okay, maybe not. I'm trying to scroll through the questions. I'm sorry. My daughter wants, Kristen is asking, my daughter wants to know if I believe in the Cornell system of note-taking as suggested by Apology of Biology curriculum. I don't believe in any system of note-taking. I think anybody who tries to make a system of note-taking is going to fits that system will fit some students and will not work for other students. Yeah, I don't know if Lee, if you could put in here whether or not they can view my other talk as a video or something like that.
They only had the 24 hours to watch the recording.
Okay, that's unfortunate. Okay, yeah. So in my other talk, I talked about note taking. Avoid computer. Don't take notes on computer. Studies have shown that that's not nearly as good as taking notes with your own hand. Figure out a way that you can take notes that allows you to review them and remember what the professor said. And I don't care what system you use to do that. Find your own system. I think that's better than trying to learn somebody's system. Find your own system that works for your notes. Also, especially if your professor posts notes, and most professors do these days, still take your own. But whenever you can't understand it, stop. Stop taking notes and just concentrate on what the professor's saying. And don't start taking notes again until you understand it. Because if you don't understand it, your notes are worthless. So especially if your professor posts the notes, then you can go review your professor's notes and make your own notes from that. If the professor doesn't post notes, still stop taking notes, but then go to your professor's office hours to try and make sure you understood what was being said. But don't take notes when you don't understand the material. Those notes will be useless for you. What would you recommend for 11-year-old boys who have not done formal science studies? Where would they start in your books? For my book, I would start in Science in the Beginning. Science in the Beginning is the first book in the series. Every book has three levels of review that determine how much the student is supposed to get from the lesson. So these lessons are multi-grade. All your elementary students should be doing the same lesson. And the depth of the lesson depends on what review they do. So even if your students are older, they can still start with the first book. They'll just do the older reviews, and then they can progress on. Don't worry about finishing the series before you go on, but do as much as you can. And then when it's time, go on to a junior high school curriculum. Chantel says, do you conduct chemistry or physics seminars for high schoolers during the summer? No, I have to have some time off from teaching. Otherwise, I get really burnt out. And also, summer tends to be the time I do a lot of conventions. So I really don't do any live teaching during the summer. Sorry about that. Noah says, I'm taking apology of physical science. Are the quarterly tests important? I don't think so, Noah. You might start wanting to take cumulative tests in some of your high school courses just for the experience, because some of your university courses will do cumulative tests. But honestly, if you can study for the test and get a good grade on the test, that's in many of my university courses either, because once again, I don't find the value in them. Other professors find a lot of value in them, so other professors will have cumulative tests. So you might want to have at least some practice with that. Hannah's asking, what online courses do I teach? I teach biology, chemistry, and physics. And at BereanBuilders.com, www.BereanBuilders.com, starting in March, you will see the list of classes and when they're offered and so forth. They're kind of pricey because, you know, you're paying for me to grade and do all of that stuff. But Stephanie's asking, would that be the same for the biology then? I'm not quite sure what that question is. Stephanie, if you could type a new question, I'm not sure what statement you're referencing for me. So when you say, would that be the same for biology then, what are you asking? That would be interesting to me, or that would allow me to answer your question. Bruce asking, how about the Life of Fred math series? You know, there's one Life of Fred book that gives a lot more problems to do, and it's called Oodles and Oodles of Problem. I think that's his algebra book. With that companion book, it's a full curriculum. All the other Life of Fred books just don't have enough of problems. And I know he says if you understand it, you don't have to do so many problems. I thoroughly disagree. So in the end, I think Life of Fred for the other books can be very good supplements, and they do explain things very well. But you got to do a lot more problems than what Life of Fred offers. What do you think of the Art of Problem Solving for algebra? I should have mentioned the Art of Problem Solving. It is a great series as long as your student thinks mathematically to begin with. For students who are naturally inclined to mathematics, Art of Problem Solving is awesome, but I don't think the average student is going to benefit from it, because it is teaching it as if this is somebody who understands, who intuitively understands math. So you might try it, but don't be disappointed if it doesn't work. That just means your student doesn't intuitively understand math. How's the apology biology different from the one that's on your website? They're the same. Berean Builders carries all of my books and all of the books that I recommend. And so some of them are Apologia books. So if the cover's the same, they're the same. So biology, physics, general science, physical science, advanced chemistry, advanced physics, they're all the same. They're just, you know, one's published by Apologia but authored by me. Eventually, Apologia is going to change that. They're moving away from me, which is fine. I really like to move away from them too, so that's a good thing. But as long as the covers are the same, the books are the same. So
we've got a few more at the top.
Yeah, I see.
Okay.
What do I think of teaching textbooks? I said I don't like to say bad things. I don't like teaching textbooks. I think the idea is very good. The execution is not good. I think it's a lower level. Now, I will say this. If your student can't learn from any of the curriculums I've recommended, then try teaching textbooks because it's better to use a curriculum that your student can learn from. But I do think it's a step down. I would compare it much more to public school math, and I think homeschoolers are a cut above that. Could you recommend a math course to take after teaching textbooks pre-calculus? Yes, I would try Ask Dr. Callahan. So it's www.askdrcallahan.com. And I would try his calculus book. It's video. You gotta, you know, it's a book with video lectures. You don't have to watch the video if you understand the book. But if you don't understand the book, you can watch the video lecture. And I think that's a really good calculus course to take. AskDrCallahan.com. What science course do you recommend for after physical science? My ninth grade is doing physical science and geometry. True, I've seen it suggested to do physics, then chemistry, then biology. He's not sure what he wants to do in life yet. In order to do physics, you have to have had basic trigonometry, which is usually taught in the end of geometry. So if your student has not had geometry, do not take physics. If your student has not had algebra 1, do not take chemistry. This is why the traditional order is biology, then chemistry, then physics. It tracks with math level. You don't need any special math to do biology. You need algebra 1 to do chemistry. You need geometry that had the basic trigonometry functions in it to do calculus. That's why you have to do it in that order, unless your student is way advanced. If your student's already had geometry, then yeah, go ahead and start with physics. The one thing I would say is most students find physics harder. So biology, chemistry, and physics is also the gentlest introduction. It's a stair-step approach. Would your online physics class be considered an AP class? Absolutely not. It's an honors high school class, but it is not an AP class. AP means it covers the same thing that you would cover in a first-year university course. Most high school students cannot do that in a year. Most high school students have trouble keeping up with an honors level class. So if you take my Exploring Creation with Physics and then my Advanced Physics in Creation, those 2 years add up to an AP class. My son is interested in engineering or computers, but he does struggle on the subject of English. Any advice? Boy, that's way outside my area. I mean, for writing, I really like Apologia has a book called Jump In. And so if he's struggling with writing, you might try Jump In. That's a nice book for struggling writers. The Institute for Excellence in Writing is pretty formulaic, but it works for a lot of students, so that might work for writing. But I really don't know much about English, so I'm sorry I can't really give you any advice on that. So sorry about that. Any book or software recommendation for CLEP? Chantel's asking, book or software recommendation for CLEP chemistry, science and math. I really like the Princeton series. So they have the cracking the CLEP for each subject. And so that's what I'd look at for cracking the CLEP by Princeton. I think those are the best companions for AP. Okay, now the person who asked, is that the same for biology then? I didn't get a repeat question from her, so I'm not sure what.
I did see the question. It was about the whether the biology book on your website was different than the biology.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we answered that one.
Yeah, right. So Brian Builders, if the covers are the same, they're the same book. Esther says my biology book is fun. Thank you, Esther. Are there any books on paleontology that I would recommend? You know what I really like? There are a couple of them that I really like. This one's a little older, so it may not be the best one, but Evolution, the Fossils Still Say No is a really good book. I also like Bones of Contention. I can't remember the author's name, but Bones of Contention is a really good paleontology book. So you might take a look at that. Bones of Contention. Okay, Stephanie, yeah, thank you. Okay, so that's all. I think I've covered all the questions. You know, I had to keep going back. Oh, here's another one. How essential is it that students excel at chemistry if they want to pursue an engineering degree? Not important at all, you know, because a lot of engineering degrees don't touch chemistry at all. You know, you could be a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, an industrial engineer, and you'll never have to do much with chemistry. So in the end, you will have to take chemistry. You will have to take freshman chemistry, but you may not have to take any other chemistry course ever, depending on what your engineering specialty is. Now, obviously, if you're a chemical engineer, you're going to have to do well in chemistry, but there's lots of engineers that don't know anything about chemistry, and they're very good engineers. I've taught some of them because I also teach physics, and so I've taught some engineers don't know anything about chemistry, but they're good engineers. Any advice for preparing the SAT or ACT? Yes, two things about the SAT or ACT. If you're a young woman, take the ACT. Young women, on average, do better on the ACT than they do on the SAT. So why not take the test that you are your gender is more suited towards? In the same vein, if you're a young man, take the SAT. Once again, why not take the test that your gender is more suited for? So that's one thing. The other thing I would do is the best thing you can do for the ACT or SAT is to take practice tests. I would get books about the SAT or ACT just to use the practice tests. Because what you want to do is you want to get used to the way that the SAT and ACT ask the questions. So more practice tests, the better. Now, obviously, when you get something wrong, go into the book and find out why it's wrong, and maybe you'll learn something you didn't know before. But the best way, I think, to study for the ACT or SAT is to take practice tests. And you want to take it from a source like Princeton or REA or Barron's. Those people have been doing fake SAT and ACT tests for a long time, so they know what the questions are like. And that's your best thing. I know the College Review Board, who makes the SAT, you can sign up for daily math questions and get daily English questions. They send you an email with an SAT question. Sign up, because that'll give you experience once a day. What's the most marketable engineering degree? That changes from year to year. When I started university, everybody said chemical engineering. I had a lot of friends who went to chemical engineering. By the time they graduated, they couldn't get jobs because everybody was doing chemical engineering because everybody had been told to do chemical engineering. So I really don't know. I would say right now, at this flash instant in time, electrical engineering, probably the most electrical engineers that specialize in hardware, not software. But that could change next year. So I really don't know. One thing that's kind of common and uniform, and I don't know, Lee may have a better answer to this because she's got engineers as kids. The engineers you'll always, always, always need are industrial engineers. So, you know, that's one of those jobs that there's always, every industry needs industrial engineers. Those aren't typically the highest paid engineers.
Right. I got to jump in and say that my son is an electrical engineer, a computer science engineer, and a something else engineer. Then he got a master's in some engineering. I don't know. And so what we've been hearing a lot about is that it is the electrical engineers and the computer engineers that are most in demand right now. It is. And I'll tell you, I agree with you. I think it changes all the time. And one thing that my son Kevin found out is that what he learned in his engineering is how to think hard and think deeply and think about a lot of different things. And that's a skill that actually can apply to many different jobs. So it's useful.
Esther says that Ariana is using biology and thinks that I'm a science superhero. Definitely not a science superhero, but I really appreciate the sentiment.
That's awesome. Well, so, okay. Thank you for coming today, Jay. This has been
great.
Pleasure. And what's really interesting is how many people just have loved the Q&A afterwards because, you know, like usual, we talk and talk and talk, and then people have questions that we would not have ever thought of putting into the presentation. So,
and that's the value. Like when I teach online classes to students, I say the best value of this is you've got the guy who wrote the book to answer your questions. So that's the value, the fact that we can go back and forth. So, you know, listening to lecture is fun, but you get a lot more out of, well, I don't know if it's fun, but but you get a lot more out of it when you can ask questions.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was great. And I really appreciate your time. I thought it was so neat. And I love how you are answering all these questions about things that are really kind of unrelated to the topic. And yet you and I agree on everything. So that it was, it was very fun for me to hear, you know, an expert saying the things that I'm always saying. So,
well, if you're experienced in the academic world, a lot of this, you know, is pretty standard knowledge in the academic world. But if you're not experienced in the academic world,
then it's all new. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming. And,
oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. And everybody who's still here, if you could please look on the poll at the end and help us out by looking over that poll, that would be great.
And just to plug myself one more time, shamelessly, my blog, which, you know, has a little bit of everything, is blog.drweil.com. It's philosophy, science, that kind of stuff. But the more important one is my publisher, where you can get my books. If you buy Apologia, it may not be my book because they may have gone to a different author. So if you want me, you need to go to BereanBuilders.com.
Right.
And then you know it's me.
Yeah. And that's actually what I tell people is that it's important to choose an author that you know and trust.
Yes.
And that's why I recommend your stuff, because you don't actually know if a science textbook is written by a scientist. If that makes sense.
Yep, so. Absolutely. Or or even an academic. Like, I have reviewed books written by scientists who aren't academics. They're in the field, and their knowledge is so focused, they don't know the general stuff. So they either ignore it or talk wrongly about it.
So
I really think, you know, textbooks need to be written by academics who have been, you know, still exposed to the broad range of whatever topic they're talking about.
Right, right. Well, and I just want to say one more time, I really love the content that you gave us today, because I know the textbooks really changed a lot when I was in nursing school from the beginning to the end. And I remember the first day of class of nursing school, and she said, "And I just want you to know that everything that you're going to be reading in your textbook is 10 years old and was outdated by the time it was published."
Yep. For those of you who are still here, the appendix is functional. We know it's function. It's a serious function. You can live in the developed world without your appendix, but you can't live in very well in the undeveloped world without your appendix. But that's something that's been taught for, you know, I was taught it in university. I just reviewed a book that was just published last year. It said the appendix is useless. Absolutely false. We've known that's false since, I think, 2004.
I got so excited when I read that on your blog. It is a great blog. So everybody follow his blog. It's really good. Okay, guys. Thanks again for coming. And we'll see you next time. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.